During the 14th and 15th centuries, the seas around Ireland were a haven for pirates from across Europe. Not only did Gaelic-Irish marauders attack English settlements in Ireland, but the period also saw French, Scottish and Spanish fleets raid English holdings from Ulster to Kinsale. Such pirates emerged from a period of international conflict and environmental change, a convergence of events that left England vulnerable and which afforded opportunities for Gaelic dynasties such as the O'Donnells of Tyrconnell to build extensive maritime, diplomatic and economic networks. Those events have been researched by Dr. Simon Egan, lecturer in medieval Irish history at Queen's University Belfast, and he joins us to discuss how late medieval Ireland was shaped by piracy, shifting alliances and the prolonged struggle for control of the seas. Simon, you're very welcome indeed to the History Show.
Thank you.
Let's start with a striking example from your own research, an incident in 1453 when Breton pirates raided Dublin Bay. Tell us what was going on, what happened?
This is a very interesting incident because I suppose on one level it encapsulates how vulnerable English towns, English possessions in Ireland are to continental enemies such as the French or the Bretons who served French at this time, or to Spanish raiders. In 1453, this is around the time the Hundred Years' War has not officially ended, but the English military position has collapsed in France. A fleet from Brittany sails into Dublin Bay. From what we can, this is all recorded in an Irish source, a Gaelic Irish source rather than an English source, which is interesting as well. But they sail into Dublin Bay. They burn quite a few ships in the harbour, in the bay, and then they somehow manage to kidnap the Archbishop of Dublin, Michael Gregory, and whisk him away up north to Ulster, where it seems he is deposited on the shoreline. He is rescued and he is brought back to Dublin. But the whole incident is very unusual. You know, he was captured. Did they intend to ransom him? Did they decide he wasn't worth holding on to? We don't know. But the whole episode, it is interesting, as I said. It tells us a lot about it. Ireland is within striking distance of England's enemies. You know, we think about maybe the first time this happens is the Spanish Armada. This is over 100 years before the Spanish Armada is dispatched to Irish waters. And we have a French force or a pro-French force attacking Dublin at this time. So again, Ireland is on the geographic periphery of Europe, but it is England's nearest neighbour and English power is vulnerable there.
Yeah, how well protected was Dublin in 1453? You talk about burning ships in the bay. Were those commercial ships? Were they naval ships?
They're mainly commercial ships. I mean, the mercantile community in the ports of the eastern seaboard seems to, you know, there seems to be a lot of merchants there. There's quite a large number of ships. The English don't really have a fleet to speak of at this time. The main naval power in Europe would be the Castilians in Spain or the Portuguese. They are the ones building the bigger ships. They're the ones testing new types of seafaring technology. The English don't really have much in the way of naval power at this time. So a lot of their means of transporting troops, moving people about, they arrest mercantile shipping and they use the merchant networks to move people and move their troops around. So Dublin is quite, it's protected well by land, it is a walled city, but by sea it is quite vulnerable. And I think 1453 really exposes just how vulnerable it is.
So they have to look after themselves, the inhabitants of Dublin, basically.
Pretty much, from the sea, yeah.
Now that raid took place, as you said, as the Hundred Years' War was coming to an end. It's more than 100 years, it's 1337 to 1453, but it's still called the Hundred Years' War. So that conflict between essentially the kingdoms of France and England had lots of ramifications for Ireland, particularly for its coastal waters. So tell us about those ramifications.
Well, it's interesting because when the Hundred Years' War breaks out in the mid-14th century, English power in Ireland is in a process of retreat. At the height of its power, it encompassed about three quarters of the island. But by the mid-14th century, certainly later 14th and early 15th century, English power is retreating to the more anglicised, the more heavily anglicised eastern seaboard. So this colony, this English colony in Ireland, is seen as a target by England's enemies. So, for example, England is at war with France and it's at war with France's allies who comprise the Scots and the Kingdom of Castile in the Iberian Peninsula. So the Scots and the Castilians are both noted pirates. We see a lot of piratical activity in the Irish Sea world at this time, directed at, let's say, we have Scottish raiders attacking ships coming out of Drogheda and Dundalk, also Dublin, but we also have Castilian raiders sailing north and attacking Kinsale, Cork, Waterford, Wexford. So it is interesting if we think about this. Ireland has, it's becoming more international, if you like, because the conflict has drawn this part of Ireland into what is primarily a European conflict. I mean, the vast majority of the fighting takes place on the continent at battlefields like Crecy, Poitiers, Agincourt. But Ireland is, it does feature in all of this, and it is a place where the English can be attacked and where they are vulnerable.
And these so-called pirates, nobody can see me, but I'm doing air quotes. Are they the kind of classic Jolly Roger privateers, that kind of pirate, walk the plank pirate, that sort of thing that this image that we have? Or are they essentially an adjunct of the war effort? Or are they a little bit of both?
Well, I suppose when we think of piracy, you know, we think of Pirates of the Caribbean and coconuts and palm trees and sunshine. We're certainly not getting any of that in Ireland at this time, or today for that matter. But it is a little bit of a combination. So it is, I suppose, a continuation of the land war at sea. These individuals, these Castilian raiders, these Spanish or Scottish raiders or Breton raiders, they are in effect continuing the war on land by sea. They are attacking various targets. Sometimes they're given permission to do so by the Crown. Other times it seems to be maybe private enterprise, shall we say. So there is, if you are the King of France, you are no doubt going to be happy that your subjects are weakening the English war effort by attacking these ports in Ireland. And if they're making a bit of extra money on the side, well, I think that can be overlooked.
And what happens with all of this after the French defeat at the Battle of Agincourt, which obviously is one of the crucial battles of the Hundred Years' War?
It's a good question. The French are in a very, very difficult position by this period. Their army has suffered a humiliating defeat. The defeat itself, militarily, was not that important, but it's what the English do immediately after Agincourt. They begin conquering Normandy and northern France. And by 1420, they're able to enforce truly humiliating terms upon the French at the Treaty of Troyes, which basically forces the French king, Charles VI, to disinherit his own son and heir and name Henry V as his heir. Within this, where does Ireland feature in all of this? We see a rise in Scottish piratical activity at this time. So the Scots kind of, I suppose, if you like, pick up the slack in the war effort against the
even though their allies have been defeated.
Even though the allies have been defeated, they're still sending men to fight in France. So there are thousands of Scots fighting in French service on the continent. And actually, in 1421, a Scottish army, there's a majority of Scots fighting in this force, they wipe out an English army and kill one of Henry V's brothers at the Battle of Bourget. And this is where the Scots earn I think it's the Pope calls them an antidote to the English at this time. So we have the Scots supporting the French in the continental war effort, but we also see a rise in Scottish piratical activity in the Irish Sea world. So they're attacking more ships. We also have a rise in Castilian naval activity in Irish water, so attacking places like Cork, Kinsale, etc.
But there's another fascinating factor involved in all of this, and it's not political, it's environmental. Mm-hmm. Explain how the Little Ice Age impacts the waters around the Irish coast.
So the Little Ice Age is a fascinating phenomenon. Broadly speaking, from about the late 13th century onwards, right true to the middle of the 19th century, the global temperatures, they enter a period of fluctuating but overall kind of gradually cooling temperatures over the course of the next few hundred years. So for instance, by the year 1400, the growing season in the Irish and British Isles has shortened by about a month. So there's less food, prices are rising, we get an increase in epizootics and panzootics, so illness in animal populations that spreads across the British Isles and Ireland, but also in Europe and Eurasia more generally. So it's a period of increasing climatic hardship that we're witnessing in this period. Now, that affects, within an Irish context, that affects the English negatively, but it also affects the Irish negatively, who are very much dependent on cattle and livestock. Where it brings an unexpected benefit to the Irish is the cooling of the North Atlantic. So going back, let's say, before the year 1250, the majority of the North Atlantic herring stocks would have been located much further north, up around Greenland. When the Atlantic begins to cool, these truly enormous shoals of herring and stocks, they migrate south to Irish waters. So by the late 14th century, the western and northern seaboards of Ireland, and Scotland for that matter, become the most bountiful fishing grounds in Europe. So this is an unexpected benefit of climate change. That means that you have fishermen from all over Europe, from the Baltic, as far away as Portugal, fishing in Irish waters, trying to exploit this new resource. So there's never been more shipping. There's never been more international shipping. There's never been more kind of long distance shipping, the late medieval equivalent of long distance shipping in Irish waters ever.
And the Irish chieftains in and along the western seaboard are able to monetize this.
They are. Now, we know based on archaeological evidence and osteo-archaeological evidence that the Irish do eat fish, they do consume the fish, but they don't fish it on the scale that these foreign fishermen do. So what the Irish do instead is they use this emergent fishing industry to make themselves wealthy, to enrich themselves. So they levy a tax upon these foreign fishermen. They're able to police this. So the Irish have their own galleys, they have their own ships, they can sail out, they can, you know, police these waters. They treat them very much as an extension of their land-based terrestrial lordships. So they apply a tax, you know, for fishing, for using parts of the shoreline to repair ships or to salt and dry the fish. So they make quite a lot of money out of this. Sometimes it does result in actual coinage, but oftentimes it results in an increase in tradable goods. So the Irish, you know, are able to trade, you know, they can trade fish or they can trade animal hides or mantles or whatever's produced in Ireland can be traded as well. And this allows the Irish to import spices, rare metals, weaponry. So by the late 15th century, they're bringing in gunpowder. So it is really significant. It also leads to a building boom in this period. This is when we get tower houses springing up along the western seaboard. These kind of miniature castles can guard the coastline. They can protect, you know, important bays, strategic bays and harbours. But we also get the kind of, I suppose, an explosion in the building of friaries. So the Franciscan order becomes very popular with the Irish aristocracy on the western seaboard in this time. And that's the ability to fund and patronise the Franciscans derives largely from the wealth generated by the fishing trade.
So this is great news for what, Fáilte Ardern would call the wild Atlantic way. Not so much, though, for the East Coast, the English-dominated towns and cities on the East Coast.
Well, we do know that the English on the eastern seaboard are participating in this fishing trade as well. They are engaging with it. They would be foolish not to. It's the English government in Ireland that is most concerned about this. So they, on a couple of occasions, they issue statutes, laws, banning foreign fishermen from fishing in Irish waters without licence. I mean, this is completely unenforceable.
Yeah, I was going to say good luck with that.
Yeah, but it is interesting. One of the statutes from 1465, so this is issued in the middle of the Wars of the Roses, it does state, it does acknowledge that the Irish have become, I think the phrase is, much advanced in terms of victuals and harness due to the fishing trade. So they are aware that the Irish are becoming more powerful, more assertive, largely due to this, the influx of fish and the ensuing fishing trade. So the English are very concerned about this, not only the wealth that the Irish are generating, but also we begin to see agents from European continental powers popping up in Irish waters and visiting the courts of the various Irish rulers. So this is something that the English were getting quite anxious about.
Because essentially, England did not control Ireland really until the 17th century. And what you have is very, very powerful Irish families, like the O'Donnells of Tyrconnell, of Donegal, Donegal plus, not just Donegal, but Tyrconnell. They are very, very rich and they build a little mini maritime empire, don't they?
They pretty much do. I mean, the O'Donnells are a fascinating case study, largely because they're one of the few families where we have a pretty good record, you know, for studying them. We've got the Irish material, but the English are also very interested in them as well. So if we look at the English material combined with the Irish material, we get a very rounded picture. So, I mean, over the course of the later 14th, 15th and early 16th century, as you say, they create pretty much what amounts to an empire. They control most of Ulster. They control a huge chunk of Connacht. They have an alliance with the King of Scots, James IV. They're importing mercenaries from Scotland all the time. One of the leaders, Éru O'Donnell, or Red Hugh O'Donnell, he's the ancestor of the other Red Hugh. Arguably, this fellow was more important, though, I would say. This Éru or Red Hugh, I mean, he's very active. He travels to Glasgow in 1495. He meets with the King of Scots. The Irish sources say he conducts an alliance with them. you know, he has the Earl of Kildare, who's the English governor in Ireland at this time. He has the Earl of Kildare in his back pocket. He has the Earl of Kildare's second-born son, who he's taken into fosterage. Now, that's how it's understood. But effectively, the Earl of Kildare's son is a hostage in Donegal this time. So the O'Donnells of Tyrconnell, they sit upon this web of dynastic, political and economic alliances that extend well beyond Ireland.
Yeah, but also allied to families and influential and important families on the West Coast, like the O'Malleys and the Burkes in Mayo.
Yeah, so they, it helps to think of the island as something that's very networked in this period. So like the Burkes of Mayo or the O'Malleys, they are kind of seafaring families as well. You know, they have their own fleets. They are engaging in the fishing trade. So the O'Donnells on their own are powerful. But when you look at the various connections they have and when the O'Donnells harness these connections, they become very, very powerful. So I think I don't think it's any exaggeration to say that by the early 16th century, families such as the O'Donnells, no Irish family has been in a position like them since the 12th century before the English invasion. When you're looking at the age of the High Kings, the O'Donnells have, they haven't quite recreated that level of power, but they're certainly coming close to it again by the 16th century. So the political and dynastic landscape of the island is really changing over this period, and to a large extent, it's driven by environmental factors.
And do the O'Donnells, do they maintain that power up until the period after the Battle of Kinsale in 1603 and the flight of the Earls in 1608?
No, there it is interrupted in the mid-16th century when there is a feud. Their power was sustained up until the kind of 1540s and 1550s. And that's when Manus O'Donnell, who was the very powerful ruler of Tyrconnell at this time.
What was he called? King of the Fish or Prince?
King of the Fish, yeah. He's known as King of the Fish in on the continent. Because, so again, this fella has status. And he's also, I mean, he writes a life of Colum Kyll at this time. You know, he's kind of viewed as a typical Renaissance.
He writes or he ghostwrites? I wonder.
I would like to think he writes it himself.
Okay,
but we'll give him the benefit of the doubt.
Okay,
you know?
Fair enough, yeah.
But again, he is a man of letters. He's been described as a Renaissance prince. You know, he's engaging in all this built heritage. He's producing all these, patronising all these manuscripts. He's engaging in international diplomacy. But he is challenged by his eldest son. He has several sons, but Calva is one of his eldest, but Calvert thinks he should be the ruler. So he ends up challenging his father for control of the lordship. His father slaps him down. So Calvert goes to Scotland to his father's old allies, the Campbells of Argyll. He travels to the Earl of Argyll's court, Archibald Campbell. And in 1555, they seal a treaty where Argyll promises to help Calvert get rid of Manus if Calvert will recognise Argyll as his overlord.
This is Dermot McMurrah and the Normans all
pretty
over
much,
again,
yeah.
Isn't it?
It's again, yeah. When you need help, you go elsewhere. So oftentimes Irish lords, they will look for help in Ireland, but sometimes when things get very bad, you go overseas. And in this case, Calva goes to his father's old ally because the O'Donnells had such strong connections with the Campbells in Scotland. The Campbells are a rising, very powerful family at this time, very, very closely attached to the monarchy. So Calva receives aid from Argyll and Manus is ousted. And that really puts a dent in O'Donnell, the kind of the power and prestige of the O'Donnells. And they don't really recover again until 1580s, early 1590s, when the real or more famous Red Hugh takes power in the lordship.
So all of this, in conclusion, has been kind of difficult to pin down historically, isn't it? Because, I mean, there are references to all of this in the annals, but they tend to be more land-focused. Archaeology tends to be more land-focused as well.
Well, actually, archaeologists have led the way here, which I think it's something that historians should pay much more attention to, the landscape and the seascape, and how the sea is conceived as not only as being part of the lordship. You know, we have poetry that talks about the various rocks that are in the sea, the various aspects of the seascape. So from the perspective of contemporaries, they certainly understood the sea as being part of your terrestrial, territorial lordship. But archaeologists, I think, have actually led the way there. And there's been some very interesting work done on places like Cork, where we have the O'Driscoll family who are based in Baltimore. In the 1360s, they sail into Waterford and they burn the docks there and they kill the mayor. You know, so they are an example of kind of a seafaring power on the south coast. But most of the information about them has been uncovered by archaeologists looking at, you know, material from the 17th century, looking at some of the plantation estates, some of the records pertaining to the plantation and working backwards from there. Environmental historians are starting to pay more attention to this environmental dimension, but it's only in the last few years. So it is a very exciting time to be a student of medieval Ireland. There's lots of interesting things happening.
Well, thank you very much indeed for coming in and talking to us. My guest is Dr. Simon Egan. The research shows us that medieval Ireland wasn't just fought over in fields and castles, but fought on the waves, where piracy, fishing, maritime conflicts played a decisive role in shaping the future of this island. Simon, many thanks indeed for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's all we've time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items, as well as podcasts, are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. My thanks tonight to Jamie Doyle and Tommy O'Sullivan on sound, and our researcher, Ian Kennelly. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer, Lorcan Clancy, goodbye, and thanks for listening.